Good morning. Open your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 3, please. And we're going to begin in 1 Timothy chapter 3. This is going to be a continuation of our series from last week as we're talking about elder qualifications. So we've got a number of visitors here this morning. Just to let you know, we're studying through 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus in our Bible class. And since we're to the part where it talks about elders and deacons, we're talking about elders and deacons, and I'm using some extra time by using a couple of sermons to talk about those qualifications. So we're going to do the same thing we did last week. We'll talk about some of those qualifications now in the 9 o'clock hour, and then the 10 o'clock Bible class, we'll have a chance to discuss those in Bible class. You can tell me all the things you disagree with of what I say, you know, and different points to make, and we'll go through all of that. 1 Timothy 3, verse 1, it is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Okay, last week we started by mentioning a balanced approach. I'm not going to re-preach that whole point, but just quickly to remind us, these are things that are required. An overseer must be these things. So we can't throw these out and just say, well, we're just going to put the best guys we got in there. At the same time, we recognize all of us are guilty of sin. And if we try to apply these standards so strictly that we think somebody's got to be absolutely flawless and perfect, we'll never appoint anybody. Nobody would meet that criteria. So there's a balance there as we just understand the biblical reality. And we notice that most of these qualities kind of exist on a spectrum. He's got to be peaceable. How peaceable? Is peaceable enough to be an elder? He's got to be hospitable. How hospitable? Is hospitable enough to be an elder? So we recognize that there's some room for judgment, tolerance, love, humility as we talk about those things and evaluate a particular person, which we're not doing right now. We're not appointing elders at Benson. We're just studying this because we've come to this point in our Bible class. And we gave Peter as an example. Early in Peter's life, you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he's impetuous, he is immature, he's making mistakes, he's saying things before he thinks. But then as we read through the Bible, he's maturing. He's getting better. Instead of denying Jesus in the book of Acts, now he's getting thrown in jail for Jesus. And so you see that courage increasing. And not perfect. Galatians 2, he's caught up in hypocrisy. But then by the time he writes 1 Peter, somewhere in the 60s AD, he's an elder. 1 Peter 5 and verse 1. And so we might be like Peter. We might have somebody that grows into the qualifications over time. We can't hold their checkered past against them if they have repented and grown past that. Okay, so with that brief introduction, let's get back to our list. And let's notice one of the family qualifications here. 1 Timothy 3, verses 4 and 5. He's got to be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Another way to translate that is he rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. Okay, so you're open there. We just read the context, verses 4 and 5. You notice verse 5 is the explanation God gives. The reason for that is you look how he is with his family, that shows you whether or not he's going to be able to take care of the church of God. So God doesn't always give explanations for the qualifications, but he does on that particular one. So they've got to be under control. Now that does not mean that the father is the kind of father that is just terrifying and angry and just, you know, belligerent. And you might say in a sense his kids are under control, but it definitely is not with dignity. So there's a difference in that. This is not some father who is maybe drunk, maybe just outrageously angry, and he's got his thumb on his kids so much that they don't dare step out of line. That's not what it's talking about. No way we would look at that guy and think, yeah, that's the guy we want taking care of the church. That's not the quality God's looking for. Now, the word dignity there, or reverence, yours might translate it that way, or gravity, respect, it's not clear in the Greek if that refers to the father or the kids. I mean, it's in reference to that situation. It's not real clear if it's talking about the dad or the kids. Greek scholars say it could go either way. It might be saying that his children are the ones who are respectful. They respect him. Maybe they respect everybody. Or it could be saying the dad, in the way that he's a father, in the way that he keeps his kids under control, it's not with that, he's a tyrant. It's with dignity. He's calm. He's dignified. The way that he's doing that. Either way, that rules out the father who's not a good leader. He's just a crazy, maybe mean guy. So if he cares for his family in such a way that the kids are submissive and respectful, that tells you a lot about the man. And then on the other hand, if he cares for his family in such a way the kids are submissive and he is doing so in a calm, dignified manner, that also tells you a lot about the man. So not a huge bit of difference there between those two options. But a side point as we consider that, those of us who are not elders and one day aspire to be elders, do your kids defy you? Or your mother, or their mother, your wife? Is that the way your house operates where maybe you and your wife just kind of, you wouldn't say the kids are in charge, but you're afraid to cross them. And so a lot of times it's kind of what they want. We don't want to go up against the kids, rock the boat, upset the kids. God doesn't think you're a qualified elder later. He's talking about people who've kept their kids under control with dignity, with respect, reverence. But the home is the proving ground. So can you rule your house well? That's a test for how well you might take care of the church of God. Reminds us of what Jesus said. Remember the parable of the talents? You who are faithful in a few things, I will put you in charge of many things. Matthew 25:21. If you're good with your family, maybe that means you'll be good with the church. Okay, similar phrasing in Titus 1:6, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Or another way to translate it is having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Okay, let me chase a rabbit on this one for a minute and give you an explanation that earlier in my life I would have said, there's no way it could mean this. This is crazy. So let me just offer this for your evaluation. And then in the 10 o'clock hour, you can poke holes in it and notice whatever weaknesses there are. Here's the question. Here's the verse, first of all. If a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, that's the Greek word pistos there, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Is that saying children must be believers, as in Christians, or just that they must be faithful, which would leave open the possibility that it's talking about faithful to the earthly father, or trustworthy or reliable is another way to translate that. When I first heard somebody suggest that, I said, well, that's obviously wrong. Everybody knows the elder kids have to be Christians. And so I checked with another older preacher, and he believed the same thing. I thought, well, he's crazy too. I checked with the third one, and he believed the same thing. I thought, what is wrong with these guys? So I had to finally take a look at it, and I'll present some information to you for you to evaluate. So don't throw tomatoes yet. At least hear me out, and then you can throw tomatoes. Okay, so when we look up the word there, pistos, there's different ways it, there's a semantic range, different meanings, which is true with all words. They can mean different things depending on the context. So the dictionaries say, you know, it can mean belief, it can mean trusting. Another one says trustworthy, faithful, firmness in faith. Vine says it could mean faithful, believing. Mount says faithful, trustworthy, reliable, dependable. Could be in reference to people, words or sayings, God and Jesus, or a believer, you know, somebody who believes or trusts in Jesus. Thayer says it means trusty or faithful. Lou and Nida say faithful, trustworthy, dependable, reliable, and so on. I'm just trying to show you dictionary. I'm flying through that, but I'm just showing you the semantic range that this word can be translated different ways. It can mean different things depending on the context. Okay, so let's look at how translations have put it. So when you're studying the Bible, it's a good idea to compare translations. Every translator is making choices on what the Greek means, how to best convey that in English. One Bible translator said it this way, translation is an inexact science. No translation is perfect. Okay, so how do translations put Titus 1:6, this particular phrase? A lot of them go with believe here. So my New American Standard 95 that I preach out of, having children who believe. Same thing in the 2020 update. Believe, 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 believe. So here's a list of translations and at least one paraphrase. I've even got the message in there to be thorough that put it as believe. A shorter list, translates it as faithful, which leaves open that possibility. Faithful to who? Could be faithful to the Father. New King James, faithful children, and so forth. And then some kind of have both. They'll have one thing in the text and then another thing in the footnote. So the ESV, for example, says his children are believers. And then the footnote in the margin or wherever it is on your page, or are faithful. And the Lexham English Bible, same thing, although opposite. Having faithful children or believing children, and so on. So there's a few examples of translations that are informing the reader of both possibilities. Okay, so there's that information. Take that for what it's worth. Now, think about context. Again, all words have a semantic range, a range of meaning, and so the way you know what it means in a particular sentence is the sentence, the paragraph, the context in which it appears. Dr. Bill Mounts is a Bible translator, and he's written a number of Greek books, including this Greek dictionary. Here's what he said in the opening pages of his dictionary: don't put too much weight on a word, which I've always thought is an interesting thing to say at the beginning of a dictionary. Don't put too much weight on a word, thinking that the word all by itself is full of meaning. Granted, there are a few technical terms that have a specific meaning in almost any context, but for the most part, we do not communicate with individual words, but with phrases, sentences, and paragraphs. Focus your study on the larger unit, hesitating to put too much emphasis on an individual word. Dr. Strauss is another Bible translator. He gives an illustration of that with two fictional newspaper headlines. The president prepares to do battle in the House over the welfare bill. And then here's another headline using four of the same words. Meeting in the White House, the president instructed Eisenhower that victory in this battle was crucial for the welfare of the nation. And he's just trying to illustrate, you know, House here means White House, House up here means House of Representatives, different presidents under consideration, different battles, different welfare meanings. He's just saying same four words, different meanings depending on the context. You could do this with almost any word. Just take the word and. My hand hurts. I'm referring to the body part. He built that by hand. Kind of includes my literal hands, but also just, I mean, manual labor. We don't want to fall, that to fall into the wrong hands. I mean, possession, and so on. I'm just trying to illustrate the context tells you what the word means. It can mean lots of different things. Context clears it up. The word love is like that. Let's use some biblical examples here. Amnon, the son of David, loved her. But if you read 2 Samuel 13, if you're familiar with that story, what does love mean in that context? I mean, he assaults her. It's lust. He's lusting for her is what it's talking about in that context. Different meaning in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church. What does love mean there? Not lust, but also not romantic love either, because it's just as Christ also loved the church. And so I would say sacrificial love is what it's talking about in Ephesians 5:25. Now, Song of Solomon, may he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Now we're talking about romantic love. And so different contexts show you different meanings. Okay, so our word in Titus 1:6 is pistos. Here's just a graph from Logos Bible Software showing different ways it's translated throughout the New Testament. Usually translated, as you can see from the graph there, is faithful or faithfully. Number two is believe, believer, believers. Could be translated as trustworthy or sure. It could mean any of those things. It just depends on the context. So, for example, here's that same Greek word in different contexts. It could mean well done, good and faithful slave. Who's the faithful and sensible steward? You've been faithful in a very little thing. God is faithful, holding fast the faithful word. This is a trustworthy statement. It's a trustworthy. That's in the yellow. That's all the same Greek word there. And then here's other contexts where it does mean believer in a religious sense. Here's doubting Thomas, you know, do not be unbelieving, but believing. Acts 16, his mom was a believer. If you judge me to be faithful to the Lord, that's Lydia in Acts 16. Galatians 3:9, Abraham's called a believer. Those who believe and know the truth, those who have believers as their masters, believers in God. So in those contexts, it is talking about believers. Okay, so again, I'm just trying to emphasize all words are like this. It depends on the context to see what it's talking about. Okay, so what is our context in Titus 1:6? Let me do one more illustration. If I say my children are cool, what does the word cool mean? Well, it depends on the rest of that sentence, right? If the rest of the sentence is, my children are cool, not warm, it means temperature. They're chilly. Give them a jacket. If the rest of the sentence is, they're cool, not weird, it means, I don't know, how do you define cool? Trendy, fashionable, appealing to young people, that kind of cool. So again, it just depends on the context. So now it's time for you to decide, what does it mean here? Titus 1:6, having pistos children. There's our word in question. And then the rest of the sentence is, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Dissipation means debauchery, being wild, indecent behavior, riotous living. Insubordination means rebellious, unruly, disobedient. What's the contrast? Is that saying children who are Christians, they're Christians, they're not wild and rebellious? Or is it saying children who are trustworthy or faithful to their earthly father, having faithful, reliable children who don't rebel against dad? Is that what it's saying? That's the question. I can see where you'd make an argument for either one. Christians is the more general concept, it seems to me. Children who are Christians are trying to avoid all sins, including dissipation and insubordination. Faithful to the father seems like the more specific contrast. Instead of being wild and rebelling against him, they're faithful to him. They're trustworthy in relation to him. Okay, so that's for you to decide. Let me mention one more thing. Harmony helps us when we study the Bible. Harmony just means look at any other verses that might help us understand something. So, for example, in Ephesians 5:18 and 19, it says, do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. Okay, so what does filled with the Spirit mean? That could mean filled with the Holy Spirit. It could mean in a miraculous way. It could mean in a non-miraculous way. What's it talking about there? And then we go to a parallel passage, Colossians 3:16, that says, let the word of Christ richly dwell within you, with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your hearts to God. Which looks, it's almost not identical, but it's a very similar passage. We can tell that seems to be a parallel passage. And if so, then that helps us understand what this is talking about here. Let the word of Christ richly dwell in you. In other words, being filled with the Spirit would mean, here's the Holy Spirit-inspired word, be filled with it. Be filled with what the Spirit has given us, the word of God. In other words, don't be drunk. Don't get drunk with wine and filled with wine. Be filled with the Scripture. Be filled with the Spirit in that sense. Okay, so do we have the same thing in our verses of interest today? Here's our word, having faithful children. And then 1 Timothy 3, 4, and 5 says, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Is that intended as a parallel? And if so, what would you think about that? Does that persuade you one way or the other? Okay, so a lot of times this is a moot point. The kids in the family are going to be both reliable, trustworthy, and baptized into Christ already, but not always. You might have a situation where here's somebody that was a good father, but he didn't become a Christian until later in life, and so he didn't teach his kids to be Christians when he was raising them. So that's worth considering. Personally, I wouldn't use this to urge a congregation to appoint a young guy. Kids are still youngsters, not necessarily because the kids aren't Christians yet, but because he hadn't been a father, I would think, long enough to prove himself as a father. Okay, so strengths and weaknesses as I see them. The strengths of this possibly being faithful to the earthly father would be, I think the context favors the more specific contrast there. And also harmony, if 1 Timothy 3, verses 4 and 5 is a parallel. Weaknesses, as we looked at that list of translations, more translations put believing in there. So if we're just counting translations, I mean, there's a weakness in our option there. And then also, is 1 Timothy supposed to be an exact parallel, or is that just supplemental information? That's a question also. So personally, I'm open to this idea. I'm not 100% convinced. And that puts me in a bad spot. I don't want to stay there forever. I don't want to bind where God's not bound or loose where God's not loose. I'd like to come down one way or the other. And so I look forward to your feedback at 10 o'clock. Positive, negative, whatever. Just tell me the strengths and weaknesses of everything. Okay, now let me address a couple more questions that often come up with the the family qualifications here. First of all, what about children who are grown and gone? Okay, he's got to be keeping his children under control. He's got to have faithful children, whatever that means. What about when the kids are grown and gone? Let me start by remembering 1 Timothy 3:2, where it says, an overseer then must be. So the primary focus is on the man himself, what an overseer must be. And obviously the qualifications mention children, but it's in what those children tell us about him, the overseer, the potential overseer. For example, let's say there's a family and dad is kind of a negligent dad. He's not there. He plays Xbox 6 hours every evening. He goes fishing every weekend. You know, he doesn't do the parenting. Mom does. She's awesome. She does 95% of the work in the home. And the kids turn out wonderful. Is he qualified? The kids are great. But what does it tell you about him? Well, everybody knows he wasn't the one doing it. And so it's not so much about the kids themselves. It's about what his dealing with the kids tells you about him. Okay, so he is the focus in this. That's all I'm trying to illustrate there. So our question now is, once they're grown and gone, does their continued behavior later in life still reflect on him? Do 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 still apply later in life? If you want to know where my thinking lies, I believe they're just talking about the father's responsibility while the children are under his care. That's what we learn about him from his kids when they were in the home. That's when they were still there. He's managing or ruling them. He's keeping them under control, charged with keeping them under control or in subjection. And that shows us whether or not he did that. Even grown sons and daughters obviously need to honor their parents. We see that in other passages, Ephesians 6:2. But the parent-child relationship naturally transitions. The children grow up. They leave the home. They're on their own. They're independent adults. They're making their own decisions. You think about, at least at marriage, you leave father and mother and join to your wife. So you're independent adults. You think about Judas betraying Jesus. That didn't reflect on Jesus' leadership. Judas was a grown man. He made his own decision. I wouldn't say that showed that Jesus was a bad leader in that case. And then you could also think about it the opposite way. Let's say the children do not do well the whole time they're growing up. They're in the home. Father's raising them. Everything's a mess. And then later on, the kids are grown and gone. They're in their 40s or 50s. And they have a change of heart. They turn to God. They're sincere Christians now. Is he qualified now because of what the kids did later in life? I would think most of us say, well, no, that was the kids' own independent decision. And that's the way I think would be the truth. The father's past was set. He didn't do what he needed to do as a father when they were under his care. And what the kids do positively wouldn't affect it. And if that's so, then what they did negatively wouldn't affect it later in life. And then you also could consider if the grown children of a qualified elder die, is he now unqualified? I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think their death would change what their raising told us about him and his character back then. So those are things to consider. Sometimes people say, well, what about Proverbs 22:6? Train up a child in the way he should go. When he's old, he will not depart from it. And that's right. My answer to that would simply be the Proverbs are general truths that do have exceptions. And sometimes a kids can be raised in all the right ways. No parent's perfect, obviously, but then they grow up and they decide to go astray. And I think other Proverbs show us that these are general truths, not 100% rules. Proverbs 18:22 says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. That's generally true. Marriage is good. But Proverbs 21:9 says, it's better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And so even Proverbs say, yeah, but there's exceptions to some of these general truths. So that's how I would answer that. Look forward to what you have to say about that later as well. Second question, must a man have a plurality of children? Okay, so the words in the verses are plural, no doubt about that. So you look at the Greek word there, it's the plural Greek word for children. So the question, though, is does the plural exclude the singular or could it possibly include the singular? In other words, what if you have a guy that's just got one kid? Could he be an elder? Is the singular possibly included? Look in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4. Let me show you three other uses of the same plural word. 1 Timothy 5:4, it's a different context now. We're talking about widows and their children. 1 Timothy 5:4, but if any widow has children, it's that plural word, or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Okay, now, so here's somebody that's got a widow in their family, and it's saying they need to step up and take care of her. What if the widow only had one child? Would the child be responsible for stepping up and taking care of her? Because it says if she has children, plural. Well, I think most of us would say, well, yeah, but if there's one child, that's included in the singular is included in the plural. And of course, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, especially those of his household, he's an infidel, worse than infidel. So yeah, that would be included. Matthew 22 and verse 24. Here's another quick example. Matthew 22 and in verse 24. Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother as next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother. So this is referring back to an old covenant law. If the man only had one child, would he have had children? Well, yeah, that would be included in that. In fact, that quote is taken from Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5, which says, dies and has no son, singular. So he is referring to singular back there. Let me do one more. Genesis 21 and verse 7. You might remember Sarah only had one child, Isaac. This is talking about Abraham and Sarah. Abraham had more kids by other women, but Sarah only had one. Genesis 21 and verse 7. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I've borne him a son in his old age. This is Hebrew now, we're in the Old Testament, but same idea there in that language. The plural would include the singular, and it's the same in English. Plural can include the singular. If someone just asked you, do you have kids or do you have children, and you just had one, you'd say, yeah. Yeah, I've got one daughter. A sign in a store might say, you must supervise your children. You say, well, I only got one kid. I don't have to supervise. No, we understand that includes the singular. Okay, so it might also help us to consider the negative side of Titus 1:6, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Well, what if you got two kids, one of them's good and one of them is rebellious? Does that disqualify him? Does he have children who are accused of rebellion? If it's disqualifying in the negative sense, then wouldn't it qualify in the positive sense? Just a single child. Okay, so that's something for you to think about. All of those points show that the plural can include the singular. The question is, does it include the singular in our passage, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1? I believe so because of the explanation given in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 5, that how he's managing his family shows you if he can take care of the church of God. If you have one kid, you're in that role of father, you're managing the family. And that shows us whether or not he can do it. Okay, now, we also, just let me mention this quickly before we move on. Some might say, we got to have multiple kids because kids are all different personalities and you got to be able to show that you can handle different personalities. Well, there might be some truth to that, but that's not in the text. We can't require it if it's not in the text itself. So we got to be careful with that. And practically speaking, how far could you take that? How many kids do you have to have before you're qualified to oversee a flock of 50 people or 100 people or 200 people? Could we start making requirements? We got to have three kids, four, Or some might say, you got to have a boy and a girl. Boys and girls are different. Congregations have men and women. So you got to know how to deal with both of them. Well, there might be some truth to that, but the text doesn't say that. So we can't require more than what the text is saying. Okay, let me move on. Holding fast the faithful word, Titus 1 and verse 9. Go back to that text, please. Titus is interesting. He's listing the criteria, and then he kind of transitions into describing the work of elders. So let's just read that in its context. Titus 1 and verse 9, holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. For there are many rebellious men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families, teaching things they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. Okay, so an elder needs to be able to hold to the word of God. Why? Well, he explains there, because people are inevitably going to come and teach error at some point, and he needs to be able to refute that. Teach the truth and refute the error, and so the Word of God is going to be central to that. So he needs to be able to Hold fast to the faithful word. No church needs elders who are modern-day Pharisees. All they know how to do is just, this is the way we've always done it, this is the way we're going to keep doing it. We need people who can go to the Word, study the Bible. What does this actually say? And go with that. Elder cannot be pugnacious. We don't really use that word much, but violent striker or bully, that's what that means. So this can't be a guy who's just itching for a fight. He wants to quarrel. He wants to maybe literally hit somebody. A lot of overlap there with some of the other requirements: temperate, prudent, able to teach, gentle, peaceable, not quick-tempered, and so on. So a guy might have been like this earlier in his life, but he needs to have repented and grown out of this, like Peter did, and matured to a point where he can be trusted to be in the middle of a heated dispute and keep his cool. I'm not going to slap somebody across the table. I was reading a book on this one time, and one commentator said this: he knew of an angry elder who challenged an obnoxious member to a fight on the church parking lot. How about that? Let's just, you know, can we imagine? So in the next hour, we're going to have a Bible class and talk about these things. And it'll probably be like last week where some people raise hands. We disagree a little bit. We say, well, here's the weakness of this. Here's the strength of this. And, there, you know, we're probably not going to be in 100% agreement. I doubt any of us is going to go out to the parking lot and fight about the thing. Okay, I think I know everybody here enough to know that's not the way it's going to work out. So an elder can't be somebody like that. That just wants to bully people into going his way. Gentle or patient. Pretty self-explanatory there. It's contrasted with being unreasonable in 1 Peter 2:18. Gentle does not mean pushover. Jesus was gentle, 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Jesus was not a pushover. Go look at any of his interactions with the Pharisees or others. He was not a pushover, but he was gentle or patient in that sense. Peaceable means not contentious, not quarrelsome. Again, it's this idea of not disposed to fight. It's literally the Greek word for fight or battle with an A on the front of it. So not fighting, not battling people, not quarrelsome or contentious. Free from the love of money, so not covetous. This is the same, kind of a form of the same word in 1 Timothy 6:10. You remember where it says, you know, the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil? This is the same thing here. This is that word with an A on the front of it. So you're not loving money like that. So free from that love. Think about what an elder's doing, the work he'll be involved in, going to be handling the church treasury. He can't be somebody who we can't trust with something like that. Not fond of sordid gain is related to that. Not greedy for gain, not greedy of filthy lucre. We don't use the word lucre anymore, really, but lucre just means money or profit, but it carries a negative connotation. So can't be one, and this is again mentioned in 1 Peter 5 and verse 2. He can't be one that we look at him and say, I don't know if we can trust him with this sort of stuff. He's got, his mind is too much on money. You know, we don't want somebody that could be bribed or somebody that is worried about upsetting the big contributors in the church or just anything like embezzling church funds, you know, stuff like that, obviously. No Christian ought to do. We certainly wouldn't want a guy to be an elder with those kind of flaws. Not a new convert, not a novice, not a recent convert. The word here literally is newly planted. The reason given for that in 1 Timothy 3:6 is interesting. It says, so that he'll not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. If I were writing that, I would say, not a new convert because he won't know what he's doing. And that might be true too, but God is wise enough to foresee what happens. You put somebody new in there, maybe the power goes to his head, whatever, and he's falls into the condemnation of the devil. Pride is going to get a hold of him there. Gets a big head. Notice, by the way, there's no number given. It's not like, you know, God doesn't say, it's got to be 10 years since he was baptized before, you know, he just, not a new convert. That's one of those things we have to consider might be relative given a situation. Somebody might be a Christian for 50 years, but they're still not maturing as they should, not qualified. Somebody else might be very mature in a much shorter period of time, so we have to take that into consideration. All right, let me do one more. Good reputation with those outside. That is well thought of by outsiders. Now, let me mention, this is not saying that the world selects our elders for us, but it is saying that an elder must be a man who behaves everywhere and with everyone. Imagine a man who behaves pretty well at church, around church people, And then if you were to go to his place of work and talk to his coworkers, they'd give you a different story. Oh, he's got a foul mouth. He's the one that's always telling dirty jokes to us, you know. Or you go to the family reunion and his family would tell you, man, he's always making indecent comments to the women around here. And, you know, it's just weird. And, you know, old Uncle so-and-so, we, you know. Or if you talk to his next door neighbors, they say, yeah, he's the neighborhood gossip. Yes. You can't have somebody like that. Somebody who's got a good reputation outside. In other words, he behaves everywhere. But this is not saying the world chooses our elders for. So don't take that too far. Also, you know, Jesus had accusations leveled against him. He was absolutely perfect. So don't take this to mean no one can ever say a bad word about you. Well, then even a perfect man had bad things said about him. So be careful with that. Okay, let me draw a line in my outline there. We'll pick it up in the Bible class hour. Thank you for your attention. I know these are kind of different kinds of sermons. Let me click over to the song we'll get to in a second. And I understand these are different. I appreciate your diligent attention. These things are important. We're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to understand God's will for us here as we think about elders and future elders. We're trying to prepare ourselves as young men for one day serving in this capacity. And so it's worth our time and it's worth our study. If there's a way we can help you now, if your soul's in need, if we can pray for you, if we can sit down with you and arrange some Bible studies in the next few days, if there's something you need to get off your chest, confess some wrong, if there's a spiritual way we can help you, please come forward while we stand and sing to encourage you.